I'm Evan Applegates. I'm a cartographer, and on Very Expensive Maps, I talk to better cartographers. This week, you'll hear from Hap Wilson, an explorer, mapmaker, and conservationist who has spent the last 50 years canoeing remote Canadian creeks, building trails, and illustrating more than 400 guide maps.
I'm Hap Wilson. That's not my real name. My real name's David, but Hap's been my professional name all my life. My wife and I live in the wintertime in cottage country, Muskoka, north of Toronto. And in the summer, we run an eco-lodge in Temagami for about 5 months. So that's our home basis throughout the year. And I hung up my paddle, so to speak, as a wilderness guide 2 years ago. So right now, we're just concentrating on running our eco-lodge up in Temagami.
How long have you been exploring the Canadian wilderness?
Yeah, that started early for me, exploration, at about age 12. And I was lucky. My father was making survival movies for the Department of Lands and Forest, and we had First Nations bushcrafters on the sets. And I learned a lot of craft from them at an early age, how to paddle. So I think my quest for exploration began at a very early age, and I started tripping at about age 12. And I just had a fascination for old maps at that time. And I knew, you know, at a young age, I wasn't going to be corporate material. So I had to find something else to do with my life that had a lot to do with canoeing and map making.
Were you an illustrator as a kid, too?
I was. And I've been illustrating since grade school. And right after high school, I had my own illustrating business. You know, I was doing illustrations for greeting cards and bar mitzvahs and all kinds of things down in Toronto. I was living in a renovated chicken shed north of Toronto, and I'd just make enough money to grub stake canoeing for 5 months in the summer.
When did you start making maps of your routes or integrating what you saw in the woods with what you would do on paper?
Yeah, you know, when I first got into serious exploration, that was, I had traveled all through Algonquin Park, and that was the only park that really had a decent enough map. But a lot of even Algonquin Park back in the 1960s was unexplored. And I found that it was hard to find good maps. And I discovered Temagami in about 1969. There were absolutely no maps available at that time. So, you know, we were using old tourism maps, and, you know, the scale was like 1 to 250,000. It's not a lot of detail. So I started taking journal notes and sketches. And, you know, eventually I pitched an idea to the local Ministry of Natural Resources in Temagami. I said, you know, you've got a lot of clear-cut logging going on. You've got all these great Aboriginal trails throughout Temagami. I said, you're going to lose them if we don't get an inventory. So they hired me to do the mapping of the 10,000 square kilometer area, and, you know, paddled over 2,500 miles that summer, compiling notes and jotting down all the information on the go-to maps, which were the 1 to 50,000 scale maps. That was the only map that was really available for any kind of wilderness trips at the time. And the only other information was very scant. And a lot of, you know, tourism in the wilderness, like backcountry travel, was beyond the old traditional canoe camps, was burgeoning back in the 70s and 80s. And we needed new maps, so I started thinking about combining old-style maps with good on-site information. So I was intrigued by the historic maps that we have in North America. And I wanted to revive that sort of hand-drawn appeal, you know, with illustrations. And I remember in public school, that really got me going in map making in the early days. You know, one of the projects was we had to draw a map, and then we brushed on milk afterwards and put the map in the oven to crisp it up and brown it up. And I just love that sepia tone of these old maps. So my first, I guess, book that came out was the Temagami Canoe Route book. And it was just basic black and white pen and ink maps. And then I graduated to more detailed maps and started adding color to it. And I knew there was a problem with recreational maps or the need for better map systems. Because if you know Canada, the fact that we have what's called a wilderness line. Most of the recreation is done below this wilderness line. As our population it's an urban population. Most of the population lives within, you know, 100 miles of the American border. So above the wilderness line, we have white print maps. some of these maps are over half a century old. And for recreational purposes, these maps are very often inaccurate. Our map system was not developed for recreational purposes. So, you know, they were for military and for political purposes. So you get a lot of paddlers out there depending on 1 to 50,000 scale maps. And I remember doing my Missinabe research with all the deaths that had occurred on that river. Half the deaths, you know, the cause of improper or inaccurate map making. And so that was one of the driving factors for creating maps that are accurate for, you know, today's market. So my maps were really twofold purposes. One is for the environment, to protect watersheds from development, and to make backcountry recreation safe for paddlers. You know, that's been my life's work. I've got over 400 hand-drawn maps now that I don't quite know what to do with that are filling up my filing cabinet.
People going down it were dying due to bad maps?
Yeah, and I remember first doing a mapping excursion, you know, mapping it out for use to put into my repertoire of backcountry guiding trips. And my wife and I actually, by accident, paddled over a deceased paddler who was pinned in the rocks below us. And the search and rescue teams were there. We thought it was just a practice exercise, but actually they were trying to get a body out of the rapids. We paddled right over it. We didn't know until days later that we found out that there was actually a person who had drowned there. So I looked into it, and I actually went down to the coroner's office in Toronto, and I went through all the reports for that river system, which, by the way, was a Canadian Heritage River and a provincial waterway park, but without accurate maps. One of the maps, you know, the white print map, where five deaths had occurred, the cartographer on an upgrade, because they wanted to build a power dam there, by guesswork, had put the portage on the wrong side of the river, where you can't possibly technically get to. So paddlers using that upgraded map tried to get to that portage and got sucked in over the falls. So five people had died there, and multiple other people had serious problems and near fatality accidents there. And that hit the front page of the Toronto Star, my research into that, problems with the 1 to 50,000 scale maps. And that's just one river, and there's 8,500 named rivers in Canada. So you can imagine how many rivers out there with inaccurate information. One of the things that the guidebooks actually helped prevent were further drownings. Up to 1994, there were an average of 2 deaths on that river based on inaccurate maps. And after the book came out, the guidebook in 1994, there have been no deaths on that river since. So it's a success story for, you know, for guidebook and mapping publications, that, you know, for the detailed, rapid information that people, you know, are forewarned in the past, where a lot of the information on top of maps was guesswork. For me, the challenge was to take a popular river that was problematic as far as available maps go and try to correct those mistakes on those maps. And also offer some kind of protection for that particular watershed.
Would you take a, I guess, inadequate 1 to 50K scale topo and then try to navigate it and mark it up and say, wow, I almost died on this one?
That's exactly it. Because, you know, in the past, on Manitoba did the same thing as Ontario. And they would hire, this is back in the early 70s when canoeing was getting more popular to the average person, not just the traditional camps. And so they would hire a student, and they'd go up in an aircraft, and they'd be plotting what they thought was the, you know, portage or rapid or fall. And a lot of that was just guesswork. So, and a lot of that got transferred, you know, eventually to some of the topo maps. And so that was not a good way to, you know, present the public with, you know, with accurate information, especially when a lot of these rivers became heritage river classifications or provincial waterway parks. So my job was to explore a lot of these rivers that basically had no information on. It was kind of modern day exploration. So I had to use the 1 to 50,000 topographic scale maps in most cases, but I would also have to run rapids, locate portages, or build portages in some cases around obstructions in the river. So that was part of our exploration, was to, you know, create new routes and to revive a lot of the old, what they call Nostoggin or Onagum, Aboriginal First Nations trails. It was to revive trails that had been there for thousands of years, and at the same time make make life a little bit easier for the backcountry traveler. It was a lot of work, but there's an art to locating old portages, and that's something that I learned at an early age with the help of First Nations when I was very young, and that I just took to my job as a professional explorer. There was a lot of risk to it because there was no information on a lot of these places that I was mapping out. There's also the excitement, that comes with risk. And if there's no risk, then there's no adventure, right? That was all part and parcel of, of the true art of exploration. I really enjoy that type of work. I kind of miss it now because, I'm going on 73 now, and I've had I'm on my third joint replacement and hernia and all those great things that come with old age and mileage. But the nice thing about map making, I'll just tell you now, is that hand-drawn maps, I never liked the digital maps. I like the old style maps. I love rehashing my field work. I'll sit down, for months and draw these maps out. It's like being back on the river, and I picture every rapid that I'm drawing in my maps. And lake and portage, and takes me back to the places that I was in the field. I'm reliving all of those great field trips that I've been on. I've logged in more than 40,000 miles by canoe at this point, and I've been very fortunate to have built this into a lifestyle and seen some pretty interesting places in this great country of ours here.
Have users of your maps ever spoken to you and said, hey, thanks for this, or you got to correct this?
I get probably almost on a daily basis through social media or just by emails, people thanking me for the work that I've done. And it makes me feel that all that work has gone to a good purpose, whether it's to protect these watersheds or to make planning and going out in wilderness areas helpful, for other people. Who may, they may not have the skills because, most people climb out of that comfort box and go on a canoe trip once a year. My maps have made it easier. I get the odd complaints, but over the years, after almost 50 years of producing these book guidebooks, I've only had a handful of complaints about portages that have changed. And maybe a portage is on the other side of a pond. It's not the same place as it was when I mapped it out. And it's because beavers have flooded the pond and washed out the traditional portage, so they had to reroute the portage. And I tell people, I have no control over the wildlife, and things change. Not a lot, along the river. The portages have been there for thousands of years. And if you look at, the trails across Ontario, the Nistoggin, a 5,000-year-old Aboriginal trail, it's the oldest still intact Aboriginal trail system in the world. And that things don't change that much. So I'm lucky in that sense. I've only had maybe half a dozen or so complaints about things that they said, well, the portage wasn't there. But I also find out that people have lost the ability to read maps. In a lot of cases, they're trying to trust a 2-inch screen on a GPS and forgot to look at the telltale traditional signs of a portage. They're expecting, big signs like they find in tended provincial parks where there's a 2-foot square portage sign. A lot of places in our country, there's no portage signs except an old blaze on a tree or a rock cairn. And people forget about looking for portages. They expect signage. And people tell me, well, next time you do your maps, make sure you put the GPS coordinates on all the portage landings. How much room that would take up on a map. And I just say, no, that's not me. I'm not, I'm going to stick to my traditional hand-drawn maps. I get a laugh because a lot of the digital map makers now are using my information on their maps. So, because they don't do the field work. They rely on people who have actually done the field work. And I still find a lot of mistakes on digital maps. They just haven't done the field work. People appreciate is the accuracy. I took a kind of a leap of faith, I guess, on when I first produced my river guide maps and to draw out actual rapids and grade them, depending on a kind of a loose framework of the international river grading system. Because every state, every province, and every canoe group has their own way of grading rapids. So the first book I did was the River of Des Moines in Quebec in the mid-1980s. And that book, I have not had one complaint about the maps that I did for that river back in the 1980s. So I'm a bit of a stickler when it comes to detail and accuracy. Plus the fact that I've been running rapids all my life. So, I don't just do a river once. I do it. I've done the river where our lodge is over 200 times. So, you know, a lot of people are collectors. They'll do a river once and then they'll move on. And I say, you don't enjoy all the nuances a river, you know, can provide to you unless you paddle it upstream and at night, you know, I tell them, or at least more than one time. So I'm fortunate that you know, I've relied on my own abilities as a paddler, an explorer, and a map maker to, you know, provide that service to recreationalists.
And a question about the process. When you were paddling these rivers, would you have a sketchbook in your dry bag? How did you keep a log of all this?
I had a pretty big map case. I have all the maps, you know, the government maps, either 1 to 250 or the 1 to 126,000 scale maps, or the 1 to 250,000 scale maps. And, you know, some of the routes, I'd be out for, you know, up to 6 weeks. So that's a lot of topographic maps. And I also have a journal, as you mentioned, with all of the detailed information. I'd, you know, pull over on a river. If there was a riffle or a rapid, I'd get out, walk, run. And, you know, this was all done before Google Earth or GPS. I have to do admit that my last book working on the Trans-Canada Water Trail, I did use Google Earth and GPS quite a bit. It makes exploration a lot easier because I remember, you know, mapping out new routes, you'd be guessing at the water depths and, you know, whether this stream had enough water to float a canoe. And sometimes you'd get into trouble and you'd have to backtrack, you know, a couple of days to get on a route that was actually navigable. Whereas Google Earth now, you can get a good bird's eye view of water flow at, you know, whether that creek or that river, you know, what that really looks like, how many rapids, you know, and mapping out new routes was a lot easier using Google Earth. So I have to admit that's an admission I'm not proud of, to tell you the truth, as an old map maker. But it does make life a little bit easier when you're still exploring new routes. I can go on Google Earth and I can zoom down and I can see if there's a lot of deadfalls. And if those deadfalls choke out a creek system that you wouldn't normally see on a topographic map, for instance, I could see that that's not a navigable route. And I actually depended on that for mapping out 1,000 miles of the Trans-Canada Water Trail that we did a few years back. That really took a lot of the field time off my back and it enabled me to actually map out an accurate route that was navigable throughout the whole season. That's the tough part, is because, as you know, water levels recede as the season progresses. So we need a route that's navigable throughout, I'd say, you know, mid-June to, you know, well into September now.
Were there any routes or creeks or rivers that you deliberately left off?
In Temagami, for example, I mapped out areas predominantly that were threatened by logging, clear-cut logging, because there was no protection in place at that time. I also interviewed a lot of the traditional camps that had been there, like Camp Keewaydin is the, you know, North America's oldest canoe camp. I would talk to the camp owners and say, what routes do you not want me to map out and make public? So there were several routes I never actually put in the first edition of the Temagami Canoe Route Guidebook. Later on, though, when logging companies wanted to get into some of these routes, I had to add these new routes and map out these new routes and put them in later editions of that guidebook. And that's what I find in a lot of places, that places that I had left out of my original guidebooks are now subject to mining, logging, power dam, all of this industrial intrusion. So now I've been looking at, adding some of these routes to some of my other guidebooks.
If it's in the guidebook by Hap Wilson, the guy who's paddled all over creation, then it'll attract people to use it, and that creates a constituency to say, hey, don't dam this.
Yeah, like in Temagami, for example, the only park in Temagami was a waterway park, and that was, and people gravitate towards parks. And there was actually more pressure on that one waterway park in Temagami in the mid-1970s than there is today. One of the reasons was to spread the traffic out over 10,000 square kilometer region, which also mirrored the old traditional First Nations canoe routes. So the idea was to spread the traffic out over a much larger area, so there'd be less impact on that one park system. We did the same. I did the same in the rivers of the Upper Ottawa, for example. There was 500 canoe parties being flown into the Des Moines River every year. So I expanded my Des Moines River guidebook into the rivers of the Upper Ottawa to spread the traffic out onto other major river systems, which were, you know, equally as nice as the Des Moines. And that's worked out well. Same with Manitoba. Did 19 rivers in Manitoba. I spent 4 years paddling Manitoba rivers and maybe came across 12 other paddlers at that whole time. It was an underused resource that was severely threatened from river diversion, a lot of mining and logging operations going on. And so the quest to there was to get people out on these rivers. The law of the wild, sort of the politics of wilderness, so to speak, rely on people getting out there. If you don't use it, you can be assured that the industrialists and the politicians know the value of the timber and know the value of a power dam, but aren't necessarily sensitive towards non-development issues or the expansion of adventure or cultural tourism, for example, which have long-term, you know, economic beneficial effects on local economies. So it's been a long haul. I've been in the environment movement up here since the early 1970s too. So that, you know, that helps inspire a lot of the explorations that I've been doing.
There's probably not one person more responsible for getting people onto backcountry canoe trails than you. They wouldn't go without the guidebook, right?
A lot of people don't rely on the guidebooks. I'm sure, you know, the old traditional paddlers. There's one funny story. You know, a lot of the new guides say, oh, I don't need Hap Wilson's guidebook, you know, and customer, or I had a fella come up to one of the trade shows that we go to, and he says, I got a funny story. I was with a paddling group coming down the Des Moines River, and our guide would stop at the top of every rapid and get out, and he was gone for about 10 minutes. And he was asked, well, what are you doing? Well, I've got a bladder infection, he said. So this fellow that was talking to me followed the guide in, and apparently the guide was secretly looking at my guidebook and how to run the rapids at every portage. And it's kind of a funny thing, but I'm happy the way things have gone. And I think people appreciate, I get so many people commending me on the books. It's nice to know that the work, all that work, you know, and the replaced joints, you know, and the arthritis, you know, was worth something.
Do you still sketch out your local terrain, or if you go somewhere new, like, oh, I gotta get the notebook out, I gotta start sketching?
No, we have another business too, and I've been building sustainable trails since I was a guide for the government. I was a park ranger in Tomogamy for 8 years, and I started building sustainable trails then, but I also map out areas for trails. That's part of what we do here. My wife and I run our eco lodge in the summer, spring and fall. We have a trail building company. We get a lot of requests from governments, municipalities, and private sector, the people who own properties but have no trails. So we map out the trails for them using traditional maps and GPS. And again, you know, just relying on that expertise that I've built up from my own work and providing, you know, and then we'll go in with a crew and build sustainable trails and with bridges, boardwalks, or, you know, wildlife viewing stations, that kind of thing. But it's all mapped out the same way we did water trails. So, and then we do the cartography, a map, like maps for the trails that we build. And so we get, we have that genre of outdoor seekers that aren't necessarily paddlers per se, but they love hiking. And they, you know, now they can walk their properties and enjoy nature on a nature trail that we've put in. And it's all based on, you know, mapping sensitive features and places of interest for people to enjoy. So that's, you know, the cartography, and we're going out every season mapping out new areas for trails.
Did you run into the same issues mapping overland trails than mapping the riverine ones? This topo is dangerous or out of date or doesn't mark what's important.
Most of that is private land. A lot of areas haven't been properly surveyed. So we have, you know, part of our exploration is trying to find old corner stakes, you know, and blazes on trees, trying to find, you know, the accuracy of some of the property lines. You know, we're pretty good at doing that as well. So that would be, I think, the biggest issues is that a lot of our trails are built on public land. You know, we have been building trails in on crown, what they call crown land here in the province, and a lot of that through the environment movement was done, you know, without permits. So, and that was one of the sort of actions that you know, environment groups would take, is to build, you know, build a trail on crown land to get people out, to protect it from logging, kind of thing. So there's a whole different aspect of what you can actually do that's considered, you know, above board, and things that you can do as a, as an environmental action. Not that I'm promoting this by, you know, by any stretch, but I mean, it's happened in the United States and Canada and other countries, is that drastic things have been done to protect wildlands. You know, one of the obstacles that we're always facing is some rules and regulations, you know, need to be stretched or broken. It's hard to get new trails built crown land these days. You know, we've tried to instigate new trails in our province here, but the government isn't that supportive of new trails and or new park systems. So it's you know, it depends on the political landscape as well. We have a conservative government in this province. You know, they're more keen on developing the resources rather than protecting resources. So that's put our conservation and environment groups kind of on hold. It's been really tough to keep up that green movement to any kind of, you know, any kind of success. That's just the politics of wilderness, I'm afraid.
Well, sometimes it requires wildcats trail building.
That's true enough, you know, chaining yourself to a Komatsu bulldozer, you know.
How very 70s.
Very 70s and 80s, and even into the 90s here. So, you know, tamogamy was an international front on the industrial movement in Canada here.
Like you said, almost all of Canada's population lives within 100 miles of the border. I never thought there'd be an industrial environmentalist collision in a land where it's almost all wilderness.
I mean, that wilderness is shrinking, you know, and as wilderness shrinks, it becomes more valuable. And this is one of the messages we're, you know, we try to get out. Roadless wilderness, we still have a lot of that. Some of the biggest clear cuts seen from satellite photography is in northern Ontario and in Manitoba, in the boreal forest. So, and people don't see that because it basically is roadless wilderness. You know, it's an ongoing struggle to find that common balance between how much do we invade that wilderness area, you know, to supply that market, you know, the market needs? How much do we protect? But it's mostly educating the bureaucrats and the politicians and sensitize them to other options other than clear-cut logging or damming, you know, new rivers. It's an ongoing struggle for our environment groups.
Mm. And so are you on the side of, if I want to enhance conservation, I got to get people in here and then show, like you said, a politician or a bureaucrat that there's a way to use this land that makes more money than simply extracting stuff out of it. Now it's a wilderness park. People spend money. That's more than you'd get in tax revenue than knocking it down and harvesting timber.
Yeah, I think that's the trouble. Like, if you look at the Ministry of Natural Resources in our province of Ontario, they're basically a licensing bureau for development. They do have a branch of Ontario Parks, and even the Ministry of the Environment are basically puppet ministries under the control of the Ministry of Natural Resources. So it's even tough for the public to demonstrate or petition for the protection of the wilderness, because all of those mandates are set in stone, basically. The cutting rights, all of this is done without public input. And a lot of it's, there's still a lot of smoke screens, you know, out there. For example, they don't call it clear cutting anymore. It's multiple species harvesting. So it's, you know, it doesn't sound as impactful. You know, basically they'll go in and cut one species, and then, a couple of years later, they'll cut all the other species. So eventually it'll be just a clear cut under a different nomenclature. So these are the kind of things that we're up against, you know, still. Smoke and mirrors, and you know, speaking out both sides of their mouth. So untrustworthy politicians that even see more money in parks now, which is a double-edged sword, because we get more people out in the minimal parks that we have in Canada, and they're getting overused, and it's expensive to go canoe camping. Tamogamy is, for example, is one of the more expensive parks to paddle in. It should be affordable to all people. And, you know, not just the elite paddler who can afford $40 a day, a night to go camping. And our politicians see the money value in wilderness parks now. That kind of defeats the purpose. And there's not enough maintenance dollars to go around. the park dollars goes into infrastructure and wages. It doesn't go out into maintenance at all. And the lack of education for outdoor paddlers, having a lot of trouble with bushcrafters going out and cutting trees at common campsites and building fireplaces, testing out their skills at building fires, you know, away from safe campfire areas. Huge concern. And the wildfires that we're fighting now are human caused, you know, from people not abiding by the no trace camping codes.
Can you think of any examples of a good success? And it was on the chopping block for extractive land, and then it turned into a well-managed recreation area or park?
We've had success stories. I mean, you know, we do have a wilderness park in Temagami, for example, and other park systems in Canada. But when you look at the amount of available areas that are very unique in this country that are not protected, we have a long way to go because, you know, as our population grows, more people want to get outdoors and nature-oriented activities. We have fewer places that can withstand that kind of traffic. It's hard to tell you any success stories at this point because a lot of our park systems, as I say, are being overused and unmaintained. We do have a lot of new conservation areas, which are great. But as far as parklands go, there's just not enough parks to withstand the pressure today. So maybe in a few years we can have the same discussion and I'll have more more good news to tell you.
Say I gave you a 20-year-old's joints. Do you have any great expeditions or mapping trips that you'd like to undertake?
I don't think I'll be doing any more mapping. The last one was mapping out the Trans-Canada Trail from Thunder Bay to Manitoba. And I think that was I swore I would never do another mapping expedition. It takes up a lot of time. And at that time, you have to buy your time because, you know, I don't get a lot of funding for that. It's mostly coming out of our own pockets. So it's tough to finance that kind of thing, travel time and studio time to do that kind of work. I can't see any big projects like that coming out. I do get requests to do small mapping projects. We did our last mapping project was to map out the North Seal River, which was great because we love that tree line area of Canada. And we did that and passed that information on to the Tsuduli Dene people who are vying for a traditional tribal park for that whole watershed, the Seal River watershed. So we were happy to engage in that and offer whatever archaeology we find, we pass on to First Nations as well, you know, to help them along to help sustain and improve their, you know, their enhancement of tourism possibilities that they are in control of. So that's, you know, working with First Nations, I think, is a priority now. From my work, passing on information that might help them give opportunities to younger people in First Nations. We've got a lot of remote First Nations communities and not a lot of opportunities for young people, but this, you know, tourism is one of the key places where they can improve. And if I can help with the cartography and map work that I've already done, pass that on to them in any way, that's what I'm doing today.
So you went to the North Seal River watershed, and did you run all the creeks, or is this an overland kind of thing?
Even though the Dene people traditionally were overland, you know, walking the Eskersnap, but they a lot different now. They travel the waterways like anybody else. That was a tough expedition for us. We spent summer and fall in that area mapping out rivers that, as far as we know, nobody's been on, the headwaters of the Seal in particular. We start from the headwater lake, which is pretty small, walking, you know, hip deep in bony rivers and trying to, you know, work our way down to rapids that are unnavigable, marking out new portage routes. That was a lot of work. And the same with the you know, mapping out the route for the Trans-Canada Trail. We had to actually clear a lot of portages by handwork, you know, carrying an axe, a saw, and a pair of loppers. So one thing is mapping it out. Another thing is that I mean, here's a national trail. We know that people are going to be following your route. So, you know, we had to flag it, map it out, and then cut the trail as we go. That entailed a lot of physical work. So, and then detailing, you know, what's navigable, what's not navigable. What can you line down? And, you know, looking at high water marks is another thing you have to read. Well, how much water will be in this creek to be able to float your canoe in the latter part of the season? So you can actually tell that by, you know, just observing marks on the rocks and the, you know, the flood line along the shoreline. So you can tell how much water goes through there in the spring flood. So you get an idea of how long maybe this creek system could be navigable until you get into mid-July or late July, and then you'll be walking down these rapids, you know, knee-deep, nursing your canoe down through rocks. That gives me an idea, and that all goes into my notes, navigation notes, so people know what to expect.
Are you going on a four-week camping trip with an axe, a loppers, and a saw?
That's exactly right.
And using a map that you're generating. The map in your hand is by default a bad map, because that's why you're standing there.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
True exploration. Having to build the trail as you map it? That's insane.
It is, yeah. You know, when I did my work in Manitoba, mapping out all those 19 rivers, I had very little money to pay for all that transportation cost and food. So I would put out to my client list, I'd say, look, I've got this route going on. It's remote. I've never been on it. People signed up, and that's how I paid for most of the exploration, is that people signed up thinking, this is great. Even the guide doesn't know anything about this river. So there's that great unknown for these clients. Sometimes it'd be dark looking for a place to set up camp, and then I have to build a campsite to put 6 to 8 people and nurse all these people down rivers that I'd never been on. It was a lot of work.
They must have trusted you.
Yeah, it became a family almost, that people joined me on several of those trips. And I did some trips for a TV station in Toronto. I did about 12 trips with Bob Hunter. He was the co-founder of Greenpeace. I got to know quite well, and did 12 trips across Canada, you know, mapping out some of these rivers and filing stories at the same time. It was all pretty exciting at the time. But a lot of work, you know, mapping out rivers at the same time, acting as a guide, trying to get these people down safely and comfortably.
Nobody signs up to never come back.
There's a few people I would have liked to have left out there, I'll tell you.
Are there any other wilderness explorers or map makers who you admire, living or dead?
I can't say that there's many or any other people doing what I do. I know there's digital map makers out there, but they don't do the same field work. I always admire the early map makers, David Thompson, for example. I love those old Canadian maps. In fact, when I was mapping out a new area, I would use maps that dated back to, you know, the early 1700s. I found out that, these are routes that they actually traveled on, alternate routes that I had eventually mapped out in modern times. So these were, in some cases, these were the only maps that were available. So no, to answer your question, I don't know anybody else doing this kind of work or who have done that to this intensity or detail.
Well, so you'd use a 1700s map made for trappers or?
Mostly it was Canadian exploration and it was driven by the fur industry at the time. And there was a race between, you know, Hudson's Bay Company and the Northwest Company and other private companies at the time to map out new areas to establish trading posts. So that was how Canada, you know, was opened. I traveled and mapped out the Hayes River in Manitoba. It was one of the main canoe routes back, you know, as early as the very late 1700s, early 1800s. Very few paddlers had used that river. I found musket balls, trade knives dating back to the early 1800s, pipes that were used at portage landings, human remains, some of these old historic routes. You know, for example, that's a 500-mile route from Lake Winnipeg to Hudson Bay that would take, you know, 3 to 4 weeks for a modern-day paddler to do, that the voyagers did in 5 to 6 days going upstream. They paddled 16 to 18 hours a day. At night, in half in the dark, they were driven. And it was all based on time, speed, getting in, because they were locked in a very short time span to get into the interior country, get the furs out and back to Montreal before freeze up. So they had to travel hundreds of miles in and back out in a season. They paddled hard and paddled long hours. A lot of them died in their 30s from rupture hernias and all kinds of ailments. A hard life. I can relate to that in a lot of respects.
Thanks to modern orthopedics, maybe those fur trappers could have gotten a few dozen more years out of it.
Yeah, I joked to my surgeon. I saw him yesterday, and he gave me shite because I was doing too much with my shoulder. And I said, yeah, that now I've got, you know, I've got a lot more Russian titanium in me. You better get that while you still can, I guess.
these routes that you paddled through, these are the original way you moved money around. These were commercial routes, and then they became people go there because they want to have a good weekend. Like, what a round trip. Like, before you could move stuff overland over a road in a semi-truck, the only way to move stuff up and down was through these rivers on the torn shoulder joints of paddlers.
You look at the river system, the major, you know, the Missouri, for example, and, you know, Lewis and Clark adventures, and opening up the West in the United States was, you know, pretty similar to what was going on in Canada for exploration and, you know, everything, you know, moving westward. At the time, it was all based on, wasn't based on recreation at all. There's no such thing as recreational canoeing until the late 1800s. Up to that time, it was all, you know, primed on speed and getting the trade forts there and you know, and ripping off the First Nations for their furs for the trinkets that they'd get in return. There's a dark path to our early explorations as well, and I won't get into that. And we're paying for that now. All the, you know, all the things that our past is catching up to us now. But yeah, recreational paddling. Something, you know, it's only been around for, you know, the last century. And our maps, the type of maps have increased in accuracy, and the need for better maps is certainly there. Map reading skills are not as good, as they're not tested like they used to be. We relied on our skills to navigate in a lot of ways when the maps fell short. And now we rely on GPS for almost everything.
Yeah, I would not want to go head-to-head orienteering with a fur trapper in 1790. I have to get overland to save my life, and my map stinks. And what's a map anyway? We read the blazes.
Yeah, some of the main routes. I mean, you look at the Mattawa River. That was a trade, one of the major trade routes was further south. Probably the main trade route, French and the Mattawa, the Ottawa Rivers. And further north, the Hayes River, for example, was the and the Churchill River, points west. Yeah, these were highways, veritable highways. There was traffic. You would probably see a York boat or a trade canoe going up and down the river every day on the Hayes River or the Mattawa River, whereas we'd go days and days without seeing anybody on the northern rivers now.
The rivers lost a lot of their economic utility, to put it, you know, dollars and cents, bureaucrat terms, when people stopped using them for move money around. And then you're kind of rediscovering it with opening it up to tourism and recreation.
Yeah, and I think one of the problems, I mean, you look at, you know, the increase in the popularity of electric vehicles, for example, and you know, our government wants to mine critical minerals in a very sensitive area of Ontario, for example. So the use of the natural resources has changed somewhat. I mean, you know, the demand for electricity, for example, I mean, that means they'll have to dam more rivers. That affects First Nations, you know, First Nation, every aspect of the natural world on a watershed, plus the release of greenhouse gases, for example. So that pressure to utilize that river resource, for example, to in other means other than recreation, has to feed this insatiable hunger for power, electricity, and electric vehicles. So, you know, it all has to be sustainable in some manner, and we have to balance that out again. How much area do we protect for recreation as opposed to how much of that do we develop? So people, when they're not out recreating and they're living in their urban, you know, suburban homes and demand all this electricity.
The eternal struggle.
Yeah.
People need energy. Well, I want to thank you so much for giving me your time, Hap. I've learned so much. Where can people find your work?
Yeah, just hapwilson.com. That's my main site. That'll take you to our Eco Trail Builders Trail Building Company and our lodge, which is Cabin Falls Eco Lodge, and that's our main business now. Our lodge up in the Wilderness Park in Temagami, and it's a learning teaching center as well. And we have trails that we've put through. We've got about 10 miles of trails through old growth, the ancient forest there. Just go to hapwilson.com or cabinfalls.ca, and that's everything that we do online now.
And any advice for next generation of explorers, wilderness people?
Get out there, enjoy it, but think of the next people that paddle by the next day. And I think if we keep vigilant with regards to protecting that resource that we so like and love to get out and enjoy, I think that's very important too. We tend to love things to death. Sometimes we love it a little bit too less and too late. So that's my message today.
Hey, have a great day, Hap. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan. My pleasure.
As a postscript, I want to emphasize how rare this is. There are very few go somewhere, do something mapmakers. Hap will go down an unexplored river carrying a whole bunch of stuff for a few weeks at a time, and then going home and logging it all in a beautiful hand-illustrated map. Hap has more in common with cartographers of 300 years ago than probably anyone else living today. If you want to make maps, you should definitely do what Hap did, which is look at the wildly inadequate maps of a territory you care about, head out there, hopefully get people to pay you for part of this, then hand draw a stunning map that gets people out into the same territory that you cherish so much. Hats off to Hap.
For show notes and bonus content, visit veryexpensivemaps.com. This episode is brought to you by The Map Consultancy, supplier of professional, data-driven maps for your decks, reports, walls, and events. Visit themapconsultancy.com to see what good maps can do for you. I'm Evan Applegate, I'm a cartographer, and you should make your own maps.
No one wants to see dull, ugly maps. If you want to get through to your customers, you need the best cartography money can buy. The Map Consultancy will create maps with your data and your branding, PowerPoint decks, annual reports, conferences and events, your office walls. The Map Consultancy does it all. Visit themapconsultancy.com and get the best maps today.